Welcome everyone in the webcast audience to the Elder Law Committee of the Trust and Estates section of the Beverly Hills Bar. I'm Terry Magaty, the chair of our committee. And the first thing I do before we start the program, we want to show appreciation for our sponsors of this committee. First sponsor is the one that's been with us for the longest time, Sanborn Team. That's Nancy Sanborn and Brian Joy. They're real estate brokers who work in the trust, probate, conservatorship space. And we really appreciate them. They've been our sponsor for many, many years. So thank you, the Sanborn team. Our next sponsor is a sponsor that's really someone, people, we know the people, but the organizations. We know if you're working in probate downtown, that's or downtown, any places really. And that's the people I'm talking about are the folks from Bond Services of California and from Liberty Mutual Surety. They're also our sponsors. They do a wonderful job. They provide great service. And I don't need to, you know, anybody who works in the probate court knows that. Just spectacular service to all of us. And they deal in the same space, trusts, conservatorships, probates. So thank you, Bond Services of California and Liberty Mutual Surety. Then we also have Pickford Escrow Company, another organization that works in our space and is very expert in the type of deals we do in trust, probate, conservatorships. So thank you very much, Pickford Escrow Company. And finally, last but not least, California Title Company. There are also in our world lots of special title issues that pop up all the time. And it's nice to have a title company that really knows those issues in our probate, trust, and conservatorship space. So thank you, California Title Company. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Stuart Levin. It's so nice when we have a speaker that I don't need to look at someone's bio because Stuart's got a long bio and he's been practicing for, you know, well over 30 years in the elder abuse litigation arena. But I don't need to look at anything because I've seen Stuart in action. So Stuart is an expert litigator and he does trials. He's an excellent trial attorney. He's an excellent strategist. And it's been such a pleasure to see him in action. I've just observed it firsthand, you know, staying calm in the middle of the storm, which a lot of these cases are storms, and just looking at things very analytically and strategically to get a great result. I mean, I've seen it over and over with Stuart. So it's such a pleasure to have him here to talk. And the title of his talk today, Follow the Red Flags, Recovering Stolen Wealth in Elder Abuse Litigation, something that I've seen Stuart do. So now we'll be honored to hear the details of that. And I'm going to turn over the floor to Stuart now, and I'm going to sign off, but I'll be back later in the program to help facilitate any questions and answers. So Stuart, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Terry. Good afternoon, everyone. We could go to the next slide, please. So as with all pieces of litigation, there's a winner and a loser. The only point I want to make right now is that if we are on the side of undoing financial elder abuse, and it's likened to a chess game, we're white. Next slide, please. So I'd like to begin by telling a story. There was a man who died leaving 17 camels to his three sons. And he had an estate plan, and the man's estate plan said, one half of the camels go to my oldest son, and one third of the camels go to my middle son, and two camels go to my youngest son. So the sons were puzzled and they had no idea what to do. 17 didn't seem to divide like that. So they went to a wise woman who told them, "I will give you one of my camels." So now they had 18 camels. The oldest son now got half, which was nine. The next son got six, and there were three camels left over. Then the wise woman said, "Now I will take my camel back," and that left two for the youngest son. So the reason I like to start with that story is the way facts come in a case, they never seem to divide, and there never seems to be two left over for the youngest son. There's always problems, and you have to kind of get to the bottom of the case to understand how to make the facts work for your case. In financial elder abuse cases, nothing happens by accident. An elder does not willingly become a victim. These are stories about individuals whose trust has been betrayed, who are misled, manipulated, or defrauded by those they relied upon. We see suspicious transfers to individuals who have no legitimate claim, dispositions that run counter to a long-established estate plan, transfers that are contrary to natural family relationships or historically close relationships. And when we see these odd transfers and the products of financial elder abuse, we are seeing red flags that point to misconduct. So just like in a football game, when the red flag is thrown, that means there's been a violation. So whenever we see the red flags, which are generally brought to us by our client, we have to look for the underlying violation. There's always a story. There's always a reason why things happen. And our job is to uncover the underlying misconduct to get the actual story that happened so we can tell it to the trier of fact or tell it to the jury. Next slide, please. Once you have your story down, it's much easier for a jury or even a judge to process the information because, as we're all apparently used to sitting around the campfire in the olden days, and all there was to do was tell stories, we're hardwired to want to hear a story. So if you can put together all the facts just before trial or during your discovery process, you're going to be able to tell a powerful story and get the processing of information on your side. Next slide, please. There is currently an epidemic of financial elder abuse. It's a crisis that continues to grow. As people get older, their property, particularly in California, appreciates in value. Their mind is more vulnerable. There was a study in Harvard Business School that says that even competent people who are aged 85 often make very bad investment decisions. So there's a piece missing as the human being gets older. And that's the piece that unscrupulous individuals can take advantage of. If a person goes into a bank with a gun and they rob a bank, they'll be lucky, as it were, to depart with a couple hundred thousand and they'll probably end up in jail. But if a person commits financial elder abuse, the rewards are much, much higher and the risks are much, much lower. So this is a very attractive proposition for unscrupulous individuals. In addition, financial elder abuse violators are often very narcissistic. They don't think they're robbing a bank. They don't think they're doing anything wrong. They think they're helping the individual that they are financially abusing. And that's why a lot of these cases go to trial. And even when people lose the trial and the judge or the jury has decided that they did commit financial exploitation of an elder, they just think everyone else is wrong. So these cases are epidemic and they require a lot of litigation commitment. Next slide, please. Now, so here's a little bit of a summary of the key statute in the Welfare and Institutions Code. Financial abuse occurs when a person or entity does any of the following: takes, secretes, appropriates, obtains, or retains any interest in real or personal property, for wrongful use or with intent to defraud or both, or assists in doing any of the described acts, or does any of the foregoing through undue influence. And in this context, wrongful use is considered to be when a person or entity knows or should have known that his conduct is likely to be harmful to the elder or dependent adult, because these cases also apply to dependent adults. So let's take an example of how we can apply this, because it's a very powerful statute. I had a case recently where an elder over the age of 65 made an unsuitable investment. At the time the elder made the investment, it seemed like a good investment. The elder indicated he understood the investment. He signed a piece of paper saying he understood the investment, he understood the risks, he understood the permutations. So for a person under 65 who's not a dependent adult, this is likely a defensible case. But what happens when you aim the elder abuse statute at this kind of situation? So in this particular case, I did a videotape deposition of a managing agent of the corporation that was responsible for selling the investment. By this time, the investment had gone south. So what were they doing? Even though the taking or secreting or appropriating of the money might not have been with wrongful use, that is, with knowledge that the conduct was likely to be harmful or was harmful, by that time, a few years down the road, everyone knew the investment had gone south, and they were continuing to retain the elder's money. So this is critical. And they knew that it was harmful to the elder because the elder had lost money. So there's two types of evidence you want to get when you're doing discovery in these cases. One is your standard discovery. You always want to be the person who does the subpoena. You don't want to rely on anyone giving you any information for free, because it's often not complete information. So you want to subpoena medical records, you want to subpoena bank statements, you want to subpoena whatever you can. But in addition, there's the kind of discovery where you can create evidence. So in this case, I had the managing agent. The managing agent acknowledged there was harm to the elder because the money was lost. Then I asked the managing agent, do you have authority to give this elderly person back their money? So managing agent, he did have authority. So I asked him, are you willing right now to commit on the record in video to give this elderly person back their money? And he said no. So now you have basically, he's admitting to statutory financial elder abuse, he's ratifying the conduct, and now you're going to expose that corporation to powerful financial elder abuse remedies, which we'll get to in a minute, plus with ratification by a corporation, the prospect of punitive damages. So if you get someone who's a managing agent and they come in to the deposition, as they often will, because they're well coached, and they don't want to ratify the conduct, and ratification is necessary to get punitive damages. So they're basically saying to whatever you ask them, well, I don't know, I was not involved. So your job in the deposition is to lay out all the evidence of the case right in front of them and educate that managing agent. So now they do know. They can't say, I don't know anymore, because you've educated them on the record. And now you can ask them, given your knowledge of the situation, does what happened meet your policies and procedures? Do you approve of what happened? Do you have authority to give the elderly money back their investment? Are you willing to do that? So this can be a very creative use of discovery, and it's often not expected. So there's the evidence you get in discovery, and the evidence you create during discovery. Now, another form of elder abuse is assisting in taking, secreting, appropriating, obtaining, or retaining real property or personal property of an elder for wrongful use or with intent to defraud. So how do you get to assisting? Well, very often we have a fact situation where someone wants to get their name on a deed. So they come up with a reason why their name should be on the deed. For example, let's refinance the loan on your property. Let's make it a 30-year instead of a 15. Let's reduce the interest rate. The elderly person may be property rich, but not have a lot of income at that point. So this person offers to co-sign the loan. And in order to co-sign the loan, that person's putting up their financial information. So they are very involved in the whole process. And the idea is that they get the loan, title is transferred to the elder and the new person, often by design and joint tenancy. And then the plan is to then put title back in the name of the elder once they get the loan, only somehow that never happens, and the person rides out the clock till the elderly person dies. So not only are we suing at that point to undo the transaction and to sue the person who was directly involved in it, but whoever assisted in it, that's the loan broker, the lender, sometimes there'll be an attorney who is involved, because those can be deep pockets. So you're not only going after getting the property back, but you're going after a deep pocket, and that can be important. And let's have the next slide. So one of the reasons it's important to have a deep pocket is that in financial elder abuse, you just have to win by preponderance of evidence. And you get attorney's fees. You get reasonable attorney's fees and costs. You not only can get reasonable attorney's fees, but if you are on a contingency fee arrangement, as I often am, you can ask for a multiple of your reasonable attorney's fees. Recently, we had a case where we got attorney's fees with a Lodestar, and it was like 1.7 our normal fee, which ends up being a very healthy fee. So if you have a deep pocket available, attorney's fees and costs can be very helpful. And if you're suing a corporation where they are deep pocket, that can really incentivize settlement. Next slide, please. Another extremely powerful remedy is double damages under Probate Code 859. So if there's The person finds that there's been bad faith, wrongfully taken, concealed, or disposed of property belonging to an elder, or is taken, concealed, or disposed of property by the use of undue influence in bad faith, or through the commission of elder or dependent adult financial abuse. So, just if you qualify under the elder abuse statute that we just looked at, which also applies equally to dependent adults, you not only can get attorney's fees with the possibility of a multiple on your regular attorney fee, hourly fee, but you can get double damages. And these double damages are not like punitive damages. They are a true penalty. You don't have to show the financial wherewithal of the defendant to get them. And this can be very, very useful, because sometimes you're only going to get half of a property back. And in that case, if you get half of the property back and you get double damages, you actually can do very well. Let's go on to the next slide, please. In order to get double damages, you do not have to show bad faith within the context of financial elder abuse. So this is a critical holding in the case of needing versus dealing. Next slide, please. Another incredible value of the double damages is you can actually, if you're suing, for example, a situation where your client is a beneficiary of a trust, and the trust was originally divided between, let's say, three siblings, and one of the siblings approached the elderly parent, the aged parent, just before they died, and was able to get a gift of a valuable piece of real property, which California, especially LA County, can be worth quite a sum. So your client not only sues to undo the transfer, but also asks the court to award double damages. Now, if the double damages mean that the property's put back into the trust, then the perpetrator of the double damages is going to, in effect, where there's three beneficiaries, get one third of the double damages back. So this court ruling said no. If you plead right and you argue correctly, you can actually ask for the double damages to be paid directly to your client, who is the proponent of the double damages and who is the successful claimant of the double damages. And another point here is there's a split of authority what double damages mean. Does it mean, for example, if the property's worth $1 million, you also get an extra million? Or does it mean that if the property's worth $1 million, you get the property back? Plus, you get twice the value of the property, which would be $2 million. And that seems to be the latest findings in cases, that the double damages relate strictly to the damages. So now, if you have a successful case where someone took property, for example, and you go all the way to the mat, you not only can get attorney's fees, you can get a multiple on your attorney's fees, you can recover the property. And above and beyond that, you can get double damages of the value of the property taken. And that double damages can be for your client only. So that can help drive settlement. And it can also incentivize you to take a case all the way through trial. Next slide, please. One of the ways you can demonstrate financial elder abuse is through undue influence. Undue influence, and we'll get to that in a bit, has a number of characteristics. And it seems to be the kind of thing that is sort of in the eye of the beholder, because people do have the right to decide what to do with their money and property. And that's why, for example, if someone signs a trust or some sort of agreement, even though that trust agreement is never executed, that is still considered financial elder abuse, and you can sue to undo that trust and get attorney's fees. Because whenever someone makes a choice what to do with their property, that is one of the bundle of rights, the choice of where you want your money and property to go. So when someone does make a choice, they are actually exercising their rights as a property owner, and courts can be very loath to upset choices. For example, there was a famous case, and this was before the caregiver statute came into being, and this may have been one of the reasons why, where an elderly person left six pieces of property to his caregivers because they had been taking very good care of him. And his family lived out in the East and in the Midwest, and they didn't have that much to do with him. So even though there was a great historical relationship, just barely in the last 6 months of his life, he changed his entire estate plan, leaving everything to his caregivers. And the judge was like, well, it's his money and property. No one has a right to inherit. He can do whatever he wants with it. So there's no undue influence. And that's why you really want to try to get that presumption of undue influence, because now you're going into the case and they have to disprove undue influence. And that is, just like it's hard to prove undue influence, it's hard to disprove undue influence when there's that presumption. So that presumption, there's two possibilities. One is the standard possibility. There's a confidential relationship, such as a close relationship between the transferor and the transferee on, let's say, a deed. Now, usually you can get the defendant to admit there's a confidential relationship because they're going to want to talk up how close they were to the transferor. Because if they weren't close, if it was just a stewardess on an airplane and they met on a flight and never saw each other again, why is there this transfer of valuable property? So confidential relationship tends to be very easy to prove. Active participation in the transaction. The best thing is when the person comes up with the deed, his or herself, and just gets the person to sign the deed. There are permutations to this. What happens if the person doesn't sign the deed, but drives the person to the notary, or calls the notary and has the notary come over, or drives the person to the attorney's office, just is somehow participating? Certainly, if the person is participating by providing their financial statement to get their name on the property, that would be active participation. But your job is always to look for that participation, that active participation. And then undue benefit is often very simple to prove because if there's a pre-existing estate plan that's contrary, for example, if someone was leaving equal shares to their kids and all of a sudden everything's going to one kid, or someone is leaving to various charities and various persons that person had a historic relationship with, and suddenly it's this new friend on the block, that's an undue benefit. So very often the undue benefit is not that hard to prove either, because almost by definition, because this is being challenged, there's a lopsided transfer to someone who doesn't deserve it. The other way you can get a presumption of undue influence is under the caregiver statute. So if someone is providing care and they're a paid caregiver, then unless certain requirements are met, there's going to be a presumption of undue influence. There was a recent case that was decertified, but it said that under the caregiver statute, so basically anything a person does can be considered care: shopping for groceries, helping with medications, cleaning the apartment, taking the person out on trips, providing companionship. There's a wide umbrella of things you can put and get caregiver status. So then what's very often litigated is payment. So there's this recent case that said that someone was getting free room and board, but they were not getting paid anything. And they were providing care for this person. And the court held, yeah, that's payment. You're getting free room and board, that's payment. If the person was involved in drafting the will, and this comes up sometimes for attorneys, because if there's no independent review and the attorney makes herself the sole trustee of the person's trust, that can, through other means, fall under the same presumptions of undue influence as under the caregiver statute. So these are just tools in your toolkit. They're quivers in your arrow, and you should always try to be using them whenever possible. Under Civil Code Section 39, there's something which is a little off the beaten track, which I've often found to be very powerful. And Code Section 39 says that a conveyance or other contract of a person of unsound mind, but not entirely without understanding, which is before a person's incompetence has been judicially determined, is subject to rescission. So basically, it kind of gives you that presumption of undue influence, because you can rescind a deed or a contract where a person is mentally on shaky ground. They're on unsound mind, which basically means maybe they need help with financial transactions. They can't balance their checkbook, but they are competent on every other way, shape, or form. And you can use Civil Code 39 to rescind the deed or the transaction you want rescinded. In order to implement Civil Code Section 39, you have to first request rescission of the document. Like, you have to send a letter asking for rescission of the deed. That used to be a problem because people would often just file lawsuits instead of sending a letter. But now there's a case that says that if you simply file a lawsuit and you seek rescission, that's deemed to be a notice of rescission. That's Guschetti versus Dugan. And you can email me if you need any citations that are not in the outline that you think might be beneficial to you. Next slide, please. Right. So here's undue influence. Undue influence means excessive persuasion that causes another person to act or refrain from acting. And that's a hard nut to crack. So that's why you want to go for a presumption of undue influence whenever you can. Next slide, please. Okay. Now we're getting into, what if a person makes a will and you want to undo the will because your contention is it's a product of undue influence, financial elder abuse, and historically, people have sort of shied away from these things because it's a very low threshold to be mentally competent. Like, a person can just, they can have moderate dementia. They can be very forgetful. They can not have much of an idea what's going on. But next slide, please. So they're not mentally competent if the following is either of the following is true. Next slide, please. Okay, so the first part is the individual does not have sufficient mental capacity to be able to understand the nature of the test of entry act, understand and recollect the nature and situation of individual's property, or remember or understand the individual's relations to living descendants, spouse, parents, and those whose interests are affected by the will. So most people know they're signing a will, so they're going to understand the nature of the test of entry act. With enough prompting, person can understand and recollect what they own. And then you have C, remember and understand the individual's relationships to people whose interests are affected by the will and their family members. So this is a very low bar. And frankly, if an attorney wants to do a will and he wants to just prompt the client and keep on doing videotapes so the client gets it right and then have the client sign the will, it's pretty easy to get through this unless the person is just really, really out of it. But nonetheless, I would not give up hope. Let's go to the next slide. Okay, so here's prong two, where you can possibly allege successfully that the person lacks mental capacity. If a person suffers from a mental disorder with symptoms including delusions or hallucinations, which delusions or hallucinations result in the individual's devising property in a way which, except for the existence of the delusions or hallucinations, the individual would not have done. So basically, there has to be a delusion or hallucination that is the driving force in the contents of that will or trust. Let's go to the next slide. Okay, let's go to the next slide for a minute. Okay, so a person can have an insane delusion. That's the spontaneous production of a diseased mind. He can believe the in existence of something which does not exist. He can believe that what does not exist does exist. And he can have a belief which a rational mind would not entertain, which you cannot undo by argument or evidence to the contrary. But a person can have these false opinions or beliefs or insane delusion, but in order to undo the will, this is the critical part. Moreover, such an insane delusion must have operated to cause the production of the will which is under attack. So how do you do that? So I had a case, for example, where there was a devious daughter who wanted her mother to change her will and to cut out her brother. So even though it was a rather large estate, she wanted the mother to cut out her brother, and that's not necessarily an easy thing to do. So, and the mother was sort of had somewhat dementia, but she wasn't out of it. She would qualify in the first prong of being having testamentary capacity. So the daughter made a point of driving home to the mother that her brother had somehow been involved in the death of their father, which was really not true. The father died of a heart attack. The brother happened to have been present, but she was able to get her mother to entertain this false opinion or belief that her mother decided was true. And because her mother decided that was true, she changed the will and she cut out her son, who is the brother of the perpetrator of the financial elder abuse. And of course, she told her attorney this is why she was doing it, that because she believed that her son had killed her husband. So this was a case where we were able to undo the will because this was a good example of an insane delusion. Another example, which is interesting, is there was a Holocaust survivor who was in her 90s. And when she came out of the concentration camps with her husband back in the day, they went to Israel. They connected with relatives. The relatives really took care of them, helped them on their feet in every way imaginable. And eventually, this lady and her husband came to the United States, where the lady came up with this incredibly successful business. But as she got older, she could no longer go to Israel every year as she had previously. In addition, she was very lonely. She didn't have any immediate family around, she didn't have any children. Her family was really these people in Israel who could only visit infrequently. This lady, which can often happen to lonely people, met a person who is about half her age. She's in her 90s, he's in his 40s. And this guy understood that this is a very wealthy person. And he started taking her out to lunch 3 days a week. He would take her out to dinner, he would hang out with her. He became her best friend. And she started taking him to meetings with her bankers. So at this point, I subpoenaed all of the, this is after her lifetime. We wanted, the relatives in Israel wanted to undo the will. We subpoenaed all of her bank records. Subpoenaing bank records is basically often not an easy thing to do. And basically, at this point, I subpoenaed all the bank records, including all of her meetings with her wealth management people. And the bank did not want to give it to me. And I used to have very long discussions with an outside lawyer designated by the bank to handle this. And it was basically a product of cajoling and just saying, I'm going to file a motion and ask for sanctions. And finally, I get these meetings that have all these notes, and the friend is there, and the bank is a little puzzled, you know. Why all of a sudden are you putting this guy on your bank accounts? Why is he now involved? Like the bank could see something as weird. So, you know, as a Holocaust survivor who basically probably had to lie to live, she just told the bank, well, all of my relatives are dead. I don't have any relatives. And when she went to her lawyer, she said the same thing. All of my relatives are dead. I don't have any relatives. So basically, my take on this was to use this as an insane delusion and argue that this was an insane delusion that operated to cause the production of the will, which is under attack. And also, let's go back up a little bit. Back up the slides, please. Back up the slides again. No, the other way. Yeah. Keep on going. Okay, fine. So, stop. Right. So here, in order to have testamentary capacity, a person has to remember and understand the individual's relations to those whose interests are affected by the will. And she had a prior estate plan that basically was leaving everything to these relatives in Israel. So because she was going around saying all of her relatives were dead, I could successfully argue that this lady did not understand her relationship with people whose interests were affected by the will, because she was under the impression, the misimpression, they were all dead. So in this case, the friend did what is commonly done by perpetrators, which is another form of just simply elder abuse, which is isolation of the elder. And he did this by becoming a gatekeeper for her communication. So anytime the relatives from Israel would call, he would get on the phone, or he'd have the call transferred to his cell phone, and he would just say this elderly lady was not available. So that's the kind of thing that happens. You kind of have to dig in and get to the bottom of it. The red flags are there. You have to understand the story of how this occurred. Okay. Let's go down back to where we were before on the slides. Another thing that comes up in these situations very often is, next slide, please. Okay, up. Sorry, go back the other way, please. So what happens is, again, apart from changing a will or a trust, again, the other target is just real property. Again, because if you can get your name on title to a deed, again, please, you're ahead of the game. Now, Very often, once more. So very often what happens is, again, people want to get their name on a deed. It's fine. People want to get their name on a deed, but they don't necessarily want to advertise that while the person is alive. Because if they advertise while a person is alive and it gets recorded, then that makes it matter of public record. The property tax bills are going to change, and very often the loved ones of the person who's the transferor is going to find out what happened. So one technique used by elder abusers is they get a deed signed, and then they don't record it. So the peculiar thing about conveying title is under the statute, in order to convey title, for there to be a valid transference of title, there has to be an intent to transfer title, and there has to be an intent to receive title. So if this is not met, then even though the deed was signed, there's no transfer of title. If the deed is recorded, then there's a presumption that on that date there was a transfer of title. But we're talking about unrecorded deeds, which can be valid transfers if they're used correctly. So, for example, I had a case where one of the children decided it would be in their interest to get more of a share of real property than their siblings. And she had her father sign deeds over to her. And she was able to persuade the father to sign deeds over to her as safekeeping to help prevent anyone from stealing the property from him. Now, just as a side note, in all of these situations, whether it's signing a trust, a will, or a deed, the act of signature takes less than several seconds. So every elderly person is actually somewhat vulnerable. And that's why I always advise people, if they're doing estate planning, it can be helpful. And there's a California Supreme Court case on point. It can be very helpful to create a situation which is the exclusive means of amending a trust or rescinding pulling real estate out of a trust. And that exclusive means can involve jumping through several hoops, which an elder abuser would likely not know about, or a brand new attorney likely would not know about. And that those hoops can be set forth in a separate amendment, which are kept apart from the regular trust. But that aside, in most instances, I would say 95% of the trusts I've seen, it's rather easy. It just takes a signature to change the trust. So in this case, the person went to an attorney, deeds were signed in favor of the elder abuser child. They were not recorded because, after all, safekeeping was the story. And the elderly person simply kept possession of the deeds. Time went on. The elderly person got severe dementia, lost her mind, basically. And at that point, the child went and recorded the deeds. So when I filed the lawsuit, I'm looking at deeds that have been created by an attorney, that were properly done, that were properly recorded. And I have the defense lawyer telling me, please take the deposition of the attorney. If you'll take the deposition of the attorney, we can just resolve this case rather quickly. So I took the deposition of the attorney, and it turned out that he had filed a gift tax return. And when he filed the gift tax return, he had had the opportunity to consult with his client, consult with the child who is now the transferee on the deeds. And when he filed the gift tax return, whether he made a mistake or not, he filed the gift tax return using the date of recording as the date of transfer. Because on the gift tax return, you have to put the date of transfer for purposes of computing any gift tax. So at trial, he wanted to validate his documents, as very often lawyers do. And they sort of look at things in a very narrow sense. They don't necessarily care what's right or wrong. They just, whatever their client signed, they want to uphold, and they want to basically validate their own competence. So he was saying that when the deeds were signed, there was an intent to convey title, and therefore the deeds were valid. But when I pointed out when he was on the stand that he had signed the gift tax return under penalty of perjury, and of course he would not perjure himself to the government and setting up the whole foundation, it came out that now the deeds had been actually transferred after the mother had lost her capacity to have intent to transfer title, and therefore those deeds were invalidated. Now, the question comes up, did I sue the lawyer? And the answer is absolutely not. So even though the lawyer was aiding and abetting, you want to be in a you don't want to be in a position, because these cases are difficult enough and the rewards are rewarding enough. You don't want to be in a position where you have some crackerjack malpractice defense lawyer getting on board, because at that point, the testimony simply could have come out differently. It could have been pitched at a different angle, and the lawyer wouldn't have been so vulnerable to a successful cross-examination as he ended up being. This also raises the point, what happens if you're involved, you're filing under 850, 859 for double damages, you want to rescind a deed or a trust or a will, so you're in probate court. Besides your probate petition, by statute under 855, you can also throw in civil claims. So when you're throwing in a civil claim for financial elder abuse, you should understand that with financial elder abuse, you don't get to rescind documents. You get monetary damages. So if you're getting monetary damages, in addition to rescinding a document, that's fantastic. Now, when you're going for monetary damages, that gives you the right to a jury trial. If you have the right to a jury trial for your financial elder abuse case, you have to maintain that by letting the court know right away that you want to maintain that constitutional right to a jury trial. And then when you actually get in front of a jury, what I found, which is very interesting, one out of 10 seniors at least are victims of financial fraud or financial elder abuse. So if you start asking the jury on voir dire, do you know anyone, or do you have family members, or do you have a loved one who's been the victim of financial elder abuse? All these stories are going to come up, and a lot of these jurors are going to be invalidated as jurors right there during voir dire. So I have found that it's actually more helpful not to raise that issue with prospective jurors and just sort of hope that it'll be a mine waiting to explode when they go back and do their deliberations, rather than exploding the mine and getting that jury, that juror invalidated right away. Okay, another example I just want to talk about, 2 minutes, is sometimes you just get really lucky. I had a case where a daughter went in, her mother was dying and on a ventilator. The daughter brought in a brand new lawyer. Somehow, I don't know why this lawyer did it, but for fees, sometimes even lawyers will decide that what they're doing is justified. And they had this lady sign a brand new trust and a brand new deed in favor of the daughter while she was dying on a ventilator. We filed the case, and lo and behold, this lady at 93 sprang back to life. She not only sprang back to life, she's off the ventilator and her mind was clear and sharp like a tack. And the trial judge said that this was a blessing. I've never had a lady this age come and testify so clearly. And when we were in closing arguments and the defense lawyer gave his closing argument, the judge said to him, "Do you want me just to overlook the testimony of this 93-year-old lady? Is that what you're asking me to do?" And we got a verdict in our favor. And this was another one of these cases where people are so narcissistic and birds of a feather tend to fly together that the defendant and her lawyer both were sending me hate mail saying that I had created a family problem, and really the mother intended to create this deed and trust the way it was done. So I hope I've given you some insight. When you see a red flag, you have to know there's a red flag because there was a violation of something that should not have happened. And when you have to look under the red flags, under the hood, things happen for a reason. Things don't happen without a reason. And when they do happen, it's your job and function as an attorney, not just to spot the red flags, but to spot the underlying story, to engage in the discovery till you understand and it clicks what actually happened. And then when you take your depositions and you do your discovery, you now have a story that you are implementing and you have a game plan and all the pieces of the puzzle fit together. So I wish you success in these cases, and they can be very gratifying because you're not only collecting money, you're restoring wealth which was illegally and immorally and wrongly taken from elderly people who deserve our respect. Thank you.
Fantastic, Stuart. What an action-packed almost an hour. And we have a question, which is a very good question, because it's maybe it opens up to a whole discussion. Standing. The question is, who has standing to sue if the elder is in denial about the abuse but is legally competent and not subject to a conservatorship? So, if you can take a crack at that question and maybe just, talk a little bit about standing to bring these actions.
Right. So if the elderly person is mentally competent, you have a shot at getting a conservatorship because if you can demonstrate there's been financial elder abuse and there's harm to an elder, that's one thing. But what I've seen is there's dubious competence, someone brings a conservatorship action, and it really backfires because the PVP attorney gets involved, advocates on behalf of the elder, the perpetrator is dressing up that elder in, brand new tuxedo, and everything is spotless and everything is arranged and everything looks good. And the elder is saying, yeah, I'm very happy. This is what I want. And then at that point, the elder, who might have had a very quasi competent job of their estate planning, gets an attorney involved, and it kind of quashes downstream the opportunity for a post lifetime or post loss of competence, elder abuse action that might have been very successful. So, yeah, if the person's competent, these things are very difficult. And at that point, I usually tell people, look, the person's competent. You're claiming you have this meaningful relationship with the elder. Go for it. Go take that person out to lunch. That person was influenced by someone else who's spending a lot of time giving that person a lot of attention. Why don't you and your family do that? And that's not something within the legal sphere, but that's just something I tell people. Because, yeah, when a person's competent, part of their property rights is to do whatever they want with their money and property, and no one has the right to inherit. So that's a great, great point.
A couple other questions. One, and there is dealing with statute of limitations. So, I'll repeat her question. How long is the statute of limitations? Do we measure by what date? She says date of confiscation, discovery. What happens if you do not allege specifically elder abuse, but did allege undue influence? So, I'll let you take a crack at that, Stuart.
Okay, well, one thing I learned from Mr. Tay Magaty is resulting trust is incredibly useful. I had a case where there was a transfer of property to a sibling, unbeknownst to my client, from the mother, and then she was told that the mother lost the property. And this was like 50 years ago. And then she found out about it. And with the resulting trust, it's 4 years from the date that you demand your rights under the resulting trust. So the facts fit the resulting trust. It was 50 years ago. I did my demand. It was no. And we actually got through a motion for summary judgment and even went to appeal on a writ and won. Because if you plead a resulting trust or constructive trust, it can actually be 4 years from the date that you demand what's rightfully yours. And the other point is, if the person is incompetent, it tolls the statute of limitations. So you can have a person who gives away money, signs a trust, signs a deed, goes incompetent for 5 years and then dies. And even though it happened more than 4 years ago, which is the financial elder abuse statute of limitations, you can then start the ball rolling on date of death because all the time the person was incompetent doesn't count. So everything is very factually specific, but I hear the question, and that's one of the challenges is making sure you're getting this filed on time.
The other another question, which is these are all good questions, but let's say you do, that you do the 120-day notice, to you have a right to contest beneficiary within 120 days, 4 months. The 120 days pass. Can you still bring an action for financial elder abuse?
Right, that's a great question. So don't forget, under financial elder abuse, you're asking for monetary damages. You're not asking for cancellation of the trust. So many attorneys do feel that you can still file for financial elder abuse because it's a 4-year statute. I've seen judges wave the magic wand in favor of that. I currently have a case that's on appeal with where that issue is embedded in that. I'm not convinced either way, but the point is you're not contesting the trust. So therefore, you should not be bound by the 120-day statute. And if your share of this trust went south and that happened because of financial elder abuse, and all you're doing is seeking financial damages, not recovery of the property, then it seems like that would still work.
Other questions. Let's see. This is from a 30,000 foot look up. Any tips for claims against insurance companies who sell dubious annuities to seniors?
So basically, the way it works with an annuity is there's going to be a large commission, and then there's going to be a cap on how much the person who buys the annuity can make. And let's say it's based upon the S&P 500. Let's say it's a 10-year annuity. So statistically, over the last 100 years, over any 10-year period, the S&P 500 has gone up considerably. So therefore, you can argue right away that the annuity is likely to cause harm to that elderly person because statistically, the chances are they're going to lose money with that annuity. And that's the whole way annuities are set up. So the company can make a ton of money, the broker can make a big commission, and the senior is subsidizing all of that. So it depends how you look at annuities. If you look at them as sort of a financial scam, then could be a great case. If you look at them as a legitimate business investment and somehow it's great, could be bad case. But then also going down the line, what happens in year 7 or 8 when the client wants their money back because they need the money and the company is retaining the money and it's causing harm to the elder because now the elder needs that money, doesn't want it tied up anymore. Let's say the elder lost all their money. Now it's causing harm to the elder. So you have retention causing harm to the elder. So that's a financial elder abuse case. So these kinds of cases, you have to be creative, but I think the statute is a very powerful statute. It's practically a strict liability statute.
We've got another question, which I'm going to add in a word. It is, what is the estate planner's responsibility? I'm going to add in, or liability. If the client who has dementia or has delusions wants to change his will or trust, person with dementia or delusions goes into mild-mannered attorney, what is responsibility and liability? So is that attorney going to be on the hook?
Right. So my understanding is the attorney's duty is to the client. Unless the attorney actually understands this person is incompetent. Or, for example, let's take our case where the elderly lady said, "All my relatives are dead," and the and therefore didn't understand the nature of their relationship to their objects of their bounty or their prior trust beneficiaries. And let's say these relatives start calling the attorney's office and saying, "Hey, what's going on with our cousin? She's, we're trying to get a hold of her. Could you help us?" To now, the attorney actually realizes, slam dunk, that there's something wrong with this person's competence. That could be a problem. Or, and this is a much more likely scenario, a husband and wife come to the attorney, and one of the people has dementia, and the attorney does not get a conflict of interest waiver, and everything is going, let's say, to the competent husband's side of what he wants, and the demented person's side of things is not getting a fair shake. That could, I see, create liability for an attorney. And of course, if the attorney does something outrageous, as happened in one case where the attorney actually got a kickback commission helping facilitate the sale of insurance company insurance policy, that's a dead bang financial elder abuse case. So I guess it depends on the facts and circumstances, and that's why we lawyers have to always do our research.
I'm going to try to squeeze in one last question before we end. But okay, we have our last question is: can these claims be applied to officers of a corporation where the elder is a substantial shareholder? So I guess the idea when you're pinpointing your defendants, can an officer of the corporation be on the hook for something here? Anything come to mind?
Me just have to look if the officer of the corporation did anything that fits under the statute, then yes. But if the officer of the corporation is just, doing what he is supposed to be doing or she's supposed to be doing and exercising their best judgment, then that may be a defense. So it's too abstract for me to say, but
Got
again,
it.
it's always worth looking at the statute because I just see more of that statute every time I look at it.
Excellent. Stuart, this was, I'm going to repeat, an action-packed hour. I learned a lot, and I've been, doing these things for a while. So I really enjoyed and got a lot out of the seminar, which I'm sure everybody else in the webcast audience did too. So thank you so much. And, we have some kudos here, even in the questions. Thank you for sharing your knowledge. It was an excellent presentation. I agree. And so do, I'm sure, the folks on the webcast. So thank you, Stuart. Thank you, everybody in the audience. And we'll plan to see everybody at the next program.
And thank you for the opportunity. Have a good afternoon.
Okay, bye-bye.
You may be eligible for CLE credit in your state. Visit bhba.org/podcasts for more information.